Welcome to the June 2014 issue of Dialogues in Dermatology. The American Academy of Dermatology is accredited by the Accreditation Council for Continuing Medical Education to provide continuing medical education for physicians. The American Academy of Dermatology designates this enduring material for a maximum of 2 AMA PRA Category 1 credits. Physicians should claim only the credit commensurate with the extent of their participation in the activity. This activity is recognized by the American Academy of Dermatology for 2 AAD recognized credits and may be used toward the AAD CME award. Participation in this activity is completed by listening to dialogues on CD or a downloaded MP3 file, achievement of a 70% or higher score on the post-test, and completion of an activity evaluation. The date of original release for this issue is June 2014. The expiration date is May 2017. At the conclusion of this learning activity, participants should be able to list the underlying conditions associated with connective tissue diseases, including dermatomyositis, systemic lupus erythematosus, systemic sclerosis, and morphea. Consider utilizing diagnostic testing for onychomycosis and nail psoriasis, and identify benefits of serving as a hospitalist. Contributors to this issue of Dialogues in Dermatology have disclosed the following financial relationships. Dr. Stuart Brown is a stockholder and received stock from Johnson & Johnson Consumer Product Company and Pfizer, Inc. Dr. Adam Rubin has a relationship with Lippincott Williams & Wilkins and has received other financial benefits. All other contributors, including editors, interviewees, reviewers, and staff, reported they have no relevant relationships with commercial interests. A comprehensive list of disclosed financial relationships is available in the syllabus.
Welcome back to Dialogues in Dermatology. This is Terry Cronin, your editor-in-chief. This is Dialogues in Dermatology for June 2014, Volume 70, Issue 6. This month, we have three exciting dialogues entitled Connective Tissue Diseases, Onychomycosis and Nail Psoriasis, and The Rise of Dermatology Hospitalists. Managing patients with connective tissue diseases is a challenging task given the numerous potential systemic complications. It is essential for dermatologists who encounter patients with connective tissue diseases to be cognizant of signs and symptoms of systemic disease, as well as order the appropriate screening laboratory and imaging tests to ensure early detection and management of potential morbidities. In our next dialogue, Dr. Nicole M. Fett and Dr. Linda S. Calls discuss how we can best help our patients with connective tissue diseases.
Hi, this is Linda Calls, and I'm here with Nicole Fett, who is an assistant professor of dermatology at the University of Pennsylvania. Today we're going to talk about recommended screening practices in connective tissue diseases. And I thought maybe we would just start by having you explain how these recommendations have come about.
So it's important to know that these recommendations are based on expert opinions. So in a perfect world, we'd have randomized control trial data showing us that if we screen patients earlier and detect these comorbidities earlier, that intervening earlier improves their outcomes. But in autoimmune connective tissue diseases, because they are rare diseases, we don't have randomized controlled data supporting that. So it's all based on consensus recommendations.
And are these panels that have gotten together to meet and make recommendations? Or
in most cases, yes.
So maybe you can just sort of walk us through some of the connective tissue diseases, and we can go through sort of the associated conditions and what screening practices we should be doing. Let's start with dermatomyositis.
So in dermatomyositis, both the classic dermatomyositis variant, which means that those patients meet the Peter and Bohan criteria and have active muscle involvement, and in those patients who have clinically amyopathic dermatomyositis, meaning that they have classic cutaneous features but do not have active myositis, we know that these subsets of patients are at increased risk of having interstitial lung disease and malignancy. And so it's important to screen for interstitial lung disease and malignancy in these patients because they are two of the most highly contributors to mortality in these patients.
So what's the best screening practices to look for lung disease?
So in lung disease, we recommend that patients get pulmonary function tests with a diffusion capacity for oxygenation at diagnosis, and then annually thereafter if they have normal tests. If they have tests that show restrictive pattern, meaning that they have a decrease in their lung volumes or their FVC is less than 80%, then those patients should go on to have a high-resolution CT scan, and they should see a pulmonologist.
So would you refer the patient for pulmonary function testing without a referral to a pulmonologist initially to have a pulmonologist follow with them?
I do screen patients without having them see a pulmonologist. I do order the pulmonary function tests. The pulmonologists do a really great job if you let them know what you're looking for, of letting you know if there is a restrictive pattern and if they have a decreased diffusion capacity for oxygenation. So if patients have a normal screening test, that's probably not a good use of the pulmonologist's time to see those patients with normal lungs.
And tell me about screening for malignancy.
Screening for malignancy is a little bit more difficult. We know that all adults who have dermatomyositis are at an increased risk of malignancy compared to their age and sex-matched controls. However, if you're a 25-year-old and your risk of malignancy is elevated, it's still a minuscule risk. So it's hard to know when to start screening patients. Most people recommend that patients who are greater than 45 years of age have a full physical exam. They have a laboratory workup, so they have a CBC, comprehensive metabolic panel, a urinalysis, and then a stool guaiac. And then most people will also recommend that these patients have an annual CT scan of their chest, abdomen, and pelvis for the first 3 years.
From the diagnosis. And has there been any information on whether there's muscle involvement or not that indicates a higher risk of malignancy?
So patients who have clinically amyopathic dermatomyositis are thought to have the same risk of malignancy as those with classic, but we certainly don't have a lot of data that supports that in one way or the other. We are looking for autoantibodies that we know that increases risk of malignancy, and there's one particular antibody called TIF-gamma, which stands for transcription intermediate factor 1 gamma. The other name for this autoantibody is P155, and we know that patients that have that antibody do have an increased risk of malignancy compared to patients who don't, but it's not a perfect screening test at this point. The other thing that I want to bring up is that patients who are less than 45 years of age, we don't generally do CT scans of their chest, abdomen, and pelvis, but we know that men are at increased risk of testicular cancer, so getting an ultrasound of the testicles is important. And then in women, ovarian cancer can be very hard to detect, and ovarian cancer is overrepresented in these women. So we usually recommend that patients get a CA-125 and then a transvaginal ultrasound looking for ovarian cancer.
And is that on a yearly basis as well?
Annually for the first 3 years.
And if it's negative after 3 years, how do you follow patients after that?
Based on their symptoms, so you want to make sure that they're not losing weight for unexpected reasons or not having fevers, chills, night sweats, odd pains.
Do you still do a laboratory screening evaluation on these patients? Or not?
That's not recommended at this time.
Great. And how about moving along to lupus? What other systemic involvement do we need to look for?
So in cutaneous lupus, we need to screen patients for systemic lupus. So it's important to run through that review of systems that the ACR has in their clinical criteria for SLE.
We all have mnemonics.
And then the other thing that's important to remember in cutaneous lupus patients is that we ask them to avoid the sun, and that 90% of us get the majority of our vitamin D from UVB exposure. And so by asking patients to avoid UVR, ultraviolet radiation, we're increasing their risk of vitamin D deficiency and insufficiency, and then we're ultimately increasing their risk of osteoporosis and perhaps further immune dysregulation. And so monitoring their vitamin D levels and supplementing them is important.
Do you have them start vitamin D initially?
I will recommend to my cutaneous lupus patients that they take 1,000 international units of vitamin D per day and then test their 25-hydroxy vitamin D levels and titrate as needed.
What antibodies do you look for kidney involvement or systemic disease?
So the The labs that I most regularly order are a CBC because patients will have autoimmune mediated drops in their blood count, a urinalysis because you wouldn't want to miss lupus nephritis. I'll get a creatinine as well. A lot of patients with cutaneous lupus will have a positive ANA, and so that's not a particularly helpful test.
Great. And any other antibodies that you used for screening?
At their initial appointment, I will get anti-Smith, double-stranded DNA, SSA, SSB, all of the ENA antibodies, and then looking for antiphospholipid antibodies as well. Unless they have a change in their disease state or they've developed a clot or something along those lines, I don't regularly monitor for autoantibody formation. Anti-double-stranded DNA is a high risk for kidney involvement, and so if a patient has a double-stranded DNA antibody, you want to regularly, at least I would say every 6 months, make sure that their creatinine and their urinalysis is performed. But not everybody with a double-stranded DNA antibody has lupus nephritis.
So let's move on to morphia. What sort of systemic morbidities do we need to screen for in patients with morphia?
So it's important to remember that morphia does not increase your risk of systemic sclerosis. And in fact, morphia doesn't really have systemic comorbidities, other than in children who have head and neck involvement, they can have asymptomatic anterior segment inflammation. And those children should have eye exams every 3 to 4 months for the first 3 years after their diagnosis, because anterior segment inflammation is easily treatable with topical steroids. In a study that was performed, these children had this manifestation, but it was asymptomatic and they lost vision. So if we can screen them for that manifestation, we can treat it and we'll prevent them from getting vision loss.
And only children that have involvement on the head or neck.
Correct.
That we would need to look for that and have our ophthalmologist follow these patients.
A more controversial topic in morphia is whether or not we should be getting MRIs of all children who have head and neck involvement. And there was a recent study showing that the amount of morphia on the head and neck did not correlate with MRI findings. And in fact, children's reporting neurologic symptoms also did not correlate with MRI findings. And to date, we don't have any data on what we should do with children who have MRI findings but have skin findings that we would not treat. And so at this point, I do not recommend getting an MRI for every child who has head and neck morphia.
Great. And how about systemic sclerosis then?
Systemic sclerosis has a lot of systemic manifestations. So those patients are at very high risk of interstitial lung disease. Patients with the limited cutaneous variant of systemic sclerosis are at fairly high risk of pulmonary artery hypertension. And then patients with diffuse cutaneous systemic sclerosis are at moderate risk of getting renal crisis. And all three of these complications cause significant decrease in lifespan.
If we see a patient with this, how should we be following them?
So patients with systemic sclerosis should have annual pulmonary function tests, again, with the diffusion capacity for oxygenation. So like in our dermatomyositis patients, we're looking for a restrictive pattern. So we're looking for a decrease in their lung volumes and a decrease in their FVC and a decrease in their DLCO. If they have these findings, you're not done. You need to order a high-resolution CT scan, again, looking for interstitial lung disease, and then transferring them to pulmonology or consulting a pulmonologist. We also want to screen for pulmonary artery hypertension, so these patients should also have an annual transthoracic echocardiogram, and that will let you know if they have increased pulmonary pressures. So the cardiologist will report out what's called an EPAP, an estimated pulmonary artery pressure, and if that number is greater than 30, that's worrisome for pulmonary hypertension. Unfortunately, transthoracic echocardiograms can only tell you if a patient has pulmonary hypertension, but it can't tell you the etiology of that hypertension. And these patients have a specific type of pulmonary hypertension, the pulmonary artery hypertension, meaning that there's sclerosis of the actual pulmonary artery. And so if patients have an elevated pressure, they need to see a cardiologist to have a right heart cath to be able to actually measure the pressure in the pulmonary artery.
And see if it's related to the disease or not.
Correct, yeah, because things like interstitial lung disease or left heart failure can increase the pulmonary pressures as well.
How is that treated then from the cardiologists?
So most of the time, these patients will be transitioned to an acute care pulmonologist. So there are pulmonologists who specialize in the care of patients who have have pulmonary artery hypertension. And there's actually been a lot of really nice data on vasodilators. So these patients now have a lot of options that 5-10 years ago they did not have.
And does it help their skin disease being on these vasodilators as well?
It helps the Raynaud's phenomenon, but not the sclerosis part of things.
And how about the renal crisis?
So for a renal crisis, it's important to monitor patient's blood pressure when they come into the office. And then you're also looking for an elevated creatinine, signs of hemolysis or proteinuria on their urinalysis, so getting a UA, and then also making sure that they don't have evidence of hemolysis, so getting a CBC, making sure their blood counts haven't dropped. It's important for your patients to know that they're at risk for this as well. And so I'll ask patients to buy a home blood pressure cuff and regularly monitor their blood pressure and let them know what parameters should give us a phone call.
And how often do you ask them to check their blood pressure? Weekly or?
Several times a week, two or three times a week.
Great. Good. And how often and what are you looking for to monitor for renal crisis?
So for renal crisis, it's important for blood pressure measurements to happen in the office. So I usually see these patients every 2 to 3 months, and then getting blood tests looking for evidence of hemolysis. So that means you're going to get a CBC to make sure that they're not newly anemic. You're going to get a urinalysis to look for evidence of blood and protein. And then you need to get a creatinine to make sure that their creatinine isn't rising. Patients also should have a home blood pressure cuff, and they should be regularly checking their blood pressure 2 to 3 times a week. And if they have a dramatic elevation in their blood pressure, they should know that that is an emergency and they should call the office.
Well, I think this is really useful information for practicing dermatologists to have an outline of what screening tests do.
And certainly if they feel uncomfortable ordering these tests, there's studies showing that our rheumatology counterparts aren't perfect at doing this either. And so if you're sharing care with a rheumatologist, just asking the patient, making sure, reminding the patient that they're regularly having these screening tests so that they can go back to their rheumatologist and have them ordered.
Great. Well, thank you for coming and speaking with me. It was very informative.
Thank you.
Dr. Fett offered practical guidelines in the initial screening and subsequent follow-ups of patients with 4 common connective tissue diseases: dermatomyositis, systemic lupus erythematosus, systemic sclerosis, and morphea. In approaching patients with dermatomyositis or DM, the focus should be twofold: screening for associated malignancy and systemic involvement of disease. All adults with DM have an increased risk of malignancy compared to their age and gender-matched controls, with peak incidence in the first 2 years from diagnosis. Thus, for the first 3 years after diagnosis, all DM patients should be screened with regular full physical exams, including rectal and genital pelvic examinations, complete review of systems including unexpected weight loss, fever, chills, night sweats, and odd pains, and laboratory screening including complete blood count, complete metabolic panel, urinalysis, and stool guaiac. In addition, patients 45 years or older should have an annual CT scan of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis. Age-appropriate screening such as colonoscopy and mammography should be reiterated. Gender-specific screening should include testicular cancer screening in men with ultrasound of the testes and ovarian cancer screening in women with CA125 and transvaginal ultrasound. While anti-P155, transcription intermediary factor 1 gamma antibody positivity, is associated with an increased risk of malignancy in DM, it is not used as a screening test for malignancy. Interstitial lung disease, or ILD, is a major cause of morbidity and mortality in dermatomyositis. With ILD, pulmonary function tests will show a restrictive pattern with an abnormal diffusion capacity of the lung for carbon monoxide, or DLCO. In contrast to DM-associated respiratory muscle weakness, which should only show restrictive pattern without a decrease in DLCO. The presence of antisynthetase antibodies is associated with ILD and should prompt more vigilance of screening for pulmonary symptoms. Systemic lupus erythematosus, or SLE, is a prototypical autoimmune disease with a multitude of internal organ manifestations. Initial screening in patients suspected of SLE should include a full autoantibody panel, including anti-Smith, double-stranded DNA, SSA, SSB, all ENA antibodies, and antiphospholipid antibodies. Regular monitoring of autoantibodies is generally not necessary unless there is a change in disease state, with perhaps the exception of anti-dsDNA, which pertains to a high risk for kidney involvement. Regular follow-up labs for SLE patients should include a CBC to monitor for autoimmune anemia, as well as serum creatinine and urinalysis to monitor for lupus nephritis. Additionally, sun avoidance is an important aspect of disease prevention in SLE. However, Dr. Fett stressed the importance of monitoring vitamin D levels in the prevention of iatrogenic osteoporosis, given the expected decrease in endogenous production of the vitamin. Systemic sclerosis, or SSC, is a highly morbid multisystem disorder with potential involvement of gastrointestinal, pulmonary, renal, neuromuscular, musculoskeletal, genitourinary, and cardiac systems. One of the most serious and life-threatening manifestations is scleroderma renal crisis, characterized by acute oliguric renal failure, microangiopathic hemolysis, thrombocytopenia, and proteinuria, with or without malignant hypertension. Regular home blood pressure monitoring should be done several times per week in addition to in-office blood pressure monitoring. SSC patients should be followed every 2 to 3 months with a CMP for elevated creatinine, urinalysis to assess for hemolysis and proteinuria, and a CBC to assess for signs of hemolysis and thrombocytopenia. Pulmonary involvement is seen in more than 70% of patients with systemic sclerosis, manifesting as either interstitial lung disease or pulmonary vascular disease, both of which can lead to pulmonary arterial hypertension as a late complication of disease. Patients with SSC should have an annual PFT with DLCO and transthoracic echocardiogram. Pulmonary involvement is reflected in an abnormal pulmonary function test with a restrictive pattern and decreased DLCO, and should prompt further characterization of pulmonary disease with a high-resolution CT. An elevated pulmonary artery pressure on transthoracic echocardiogram should be followed by right heart catheterization to assess the etiology of pulmonary hypertension. The patient will need to be referred to a pulmonologist and a cardiologist for multidisciplinary management. While it is not associated with systemic sclerosis, morphea can have systemic symptoms, such as malaise, fatigue, arthralgias, myalgias, and autoantibody positivity. Children who have head and neck morphea can have asymptomatic anterior segment inflammation of the eye, leading to insidious vision loss. Thus, children with head and neck involvement should have eye exams every 3 to 4 months for the first 3 years after their diagnosis to prevent vision loss. MRI screening in children who have head and neck involvement is controversial and is generally not recommended.